Today, I'm welcoming onto Radio Gorgeous a successful author and actress who was born in New Zealand and went to RADA. She's the author of 8 novels, and today we're talking about her book, which has been re-released after 21 years because the publishers think it is so relevant today. It also sports an unusual book cover, which made Guardian writer Alison Flood ask, "Why are middle-aged women invisible on book covers?" The author is Barbara Ewing, and the book is The Actresses. Hi, Barbara. Welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Hi, Josephine. Glad to be here.
It's a pleasure. So, Barbara, can you first of all describe the book cover to us? I'll give it to you in your hand.
Yes, I don't need it in my hand. Believe me, I've talked about it so often. When it came out 21 years ago, there was a beautiful young girl in a purple sort of cover.
Young, you say? Young. How old?
Of course, young.
Mm.
Young.
How old?
Just young.
Okay.
And I cried. Oh. And went and said to the publishers, "Have you read this book?" And they said, "Look, don't worry. You write them, we'll sell them." And of course they were right, because it was a very big bestseller. But this time, the publishers, now head of Zeus, decided to put a woman of a certain age on the cover, because that's what it's about. It is set in the 90s, but it looks back to the 60s. So there's the two time periods. So they've found this face of this, I mean, she's quite beautiful.
She's very beautiful. High cheekbones.
Yes, and but there's a lot of giveaways. She's, you know how platinum hair, you sort of grey it slightly. Also, she's got slightly too much rouge on. You know how sometimes you just put a bit more on so that you look a bit more glowing. I mean, I think it's a very... But she looks really good.
Yes, yeah, she's and got a shock of grey hair, red lipstick, gorgeous
but
dark
it's,
eye makeup.
It's sort of dyed grey because, you know, it's not like grey hair. I think it's...
Well, it's had a tint, do you think?
It's had a tint, I think so. And big, big eye makeup and everything.
Which is very elegant, actually.
Extremely.
Because I think beauty has nothing to do with age. Beauty is to do with... You meet someone, you think they're beautiful. And you don't think... You don't cross how old are they. You don't think how old are they, do you? I don't, anyway.
No, well, I mean, it didn't occur to me that this was a bad idea. I was really thrilled at last the publishers had got what I was writing about, which was what happens to older women in the acting business. But, of course, we're just metaphors for women, really. Mm-hmm. And I wrote it because I was an actress and I was lucky and I was successful, but I went, because Glenda Jackson suddenly said, "I'm going to be a Member of Parliament." And I looked around and I just saw the phone was ringing less. And so I thought, well, I'm going to do something about this. And when I told my agent, she said, "Oh, darling, we can't possibly, I mean, a book about middle-aged women, I won't be able to sell it. She's our age, my age." And... I said, "Well, I'll tell what it's really like." Hmm. And I saw her face and she said, "Go on then, go for it." And I did. So, of course, why it's relevant is that it's full of quote-unquote Me Too moments, but nobody ever says anything about it. And the reviews for the book, which were very good, never said, "Is this what actresses have to put up with?" So it was just part of
it. It was taken...
Take
it on the chin.
Well,
yeah,
you know, the casting couch. Mm. And it was a different time in the women's freedoms and so on. And, you know, the pill had only just become available and things. In fact, at the beginning of when they were first at drama school, there was no pill and people had to get married and have abortions and all that stuff. So it's very interesting. They were kind of more up for things, I think. We were kind of more up for things than otherwise kicking people. You know, we just... And I'm not... This is not a generational argument, because I think what Me Too's done is absolutely fantastic. But it is a revolution, and that was then, and this is now. So I can't bear it when women of different generations argue about this. And it's all different, and the times are different, and now's the time...
We can't change the past, yeah.
No, and also Me Too is about now. And The Actresses was about then. So the cover is... Sorry, I didn't finish the story. And then when it came out, it was just like people were going past it. I mean, really going past it in bookshops. We did some experiments.
What, with the colour, with the grey hair lady?
With the woman looking... Yes, with this cover now. Mm. And it didn't take off, but of course, it in a way it took off once the once the argument about the cover went on, and it's been republished in Germany, it's going to be published in America.
With the same cover?
Ah, well, that's what I don't know. I'd be very interested to find out.
But it's fantastic that a book that you wrote 21 years ago is seen as relevant and to be brought out again. I mean, I love it.
Well, I love it too, because I felt so strongly that people like Glenda, I mean, she's come back now, but
yeah,
the first thing she came back and did was King Lear.
Mm. That's a statement. She came back as a man.
Mm. Well, I suppose it's a statement, but I thought, well, anyway, she's now playing a woman on Broadway, so it's fine. And she's come back after 80.
Why did she come back?
I suppose she wanted to. And she felt that times were different or parts were different because old, very old ladies or older than middle age, you know, a lot of us can't remember the lines anymore. You know, people say the hardest thing is when you're older is to remember lines because that part of your brain is, it's like a muscle which doesn't sort of, so you've got to work very hard at it. And she says that as well. But she was word perfect in Lear, which is a huge part. And she was 80-something.
God, it's so, so admirable.
I know.
So now let's talk about the book. It starts a reunion of actors. So this is, as you say, in the 90s. And they're looking back to
1996, I think it is. Because I just wrote it in the present day of when I was writing.
Yeah.
And it was a class reunion of this class at a drama school. Mm-hmm. We don't say which particular one, but as you've said, I went to the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art. You can guess there's some. I mean, you know, it's just
some parallels.
Well, it was a very good, and at that time thought of as a very good.
It still
drama
is
school.
The best drama school.
Oh, I'm not saying Radha. I'm saying the one in the book is it's obviously a drama school of note. And some of the actors have done marvellously. One is a Hollywood film star. One is
that's
the most...
A man
that's a man. But there is one of the women is one of the best known actresses in London, and she does stage things and just wants to break into film and is getting her great big chance. And the men are doing better and the women are not. And we hear their stories about why they're not. Some of them had to get pregnant. You know, all sorts of things happened that changed their lives and not the men's lives. And that's really... And we start in the 90s, but because of the drama of that day, which I won't tell you what it is, we go back to the past in the 60s. And so there's the two time frames. And that just seemed a good way of working it.
So when you wrote this 21 years ago and there weren't so many roles for women in there, because the women are exactly my age, 55 in the book, is it still...
Are you crying?
No, I'm not crying, no. Actually. I'm back on stage.
Yes,
but are... But then it's my own show, which I think helps. Always do your own thing. Then people can't... Anyway, diverse. Sorry, God, I'm really lost now. Oh, God.
No, go on. Starts. You said it's you're the age of the women.
Yes. Now, is it still as bad now as it was then?
There are better parts. Mm. There are more women playwrights and there are more women directors. So, of course, it's better than it was. And people like Nicole Kidman are now saying, oh, at last we can tell our story. But boy, are they going around trying to find the parts for them. She and Reese Witherspoon have set up a company and are looking for parts of women of that age. So
and also writing and producing and making them happen.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Developing the film scripts.
Yes.
Yeah.
Everything.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And not that people don't want to work with men. I'm very happy to work with men, but you've got to have, I think, women writers to make that big change. And some of that has happened, certainly, compared to the 90s.
Well, the thing I notice about film particularly, and TV, even more, well, actually more than theatre, I don't know, but it's just that men have written the play, like you say, and then it's usually about history, so it's about the past, and it's who's been in history most? Who wrote history? Men. And who fought the wars, and who was in the battles, and who were the prime ministers? Usually men.
And so, Shakespeare's plays.
Yeah.
Mostly men.
And so it's sort of... There are, will always be more roles for men. I mean, I remember when I was at drama school and they said women get on average 8 weeks of work acting and men 12. So, you know.
Ah, well, what they said to us at RADA was, and this is true and it's in the book, is take a look at the man next to you. He has 9 times as many chances as you of getting work. A, because there's more women in the profession, mm-hmm. and B, because there's less parts for women in the profession. And that was in the 60s.
Gosh, so that was, yeah, so terrible.
I know.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
all the men are working. In the reunion, all the men are working.
Yeah. And then also someone told me, because quite often I've known quite a few male actors who have had to give in their kind of 30s when they've had children and they've thought, I'm just going to have to, you know, hang up my acting scroll or whatever it is, and then I'm going to go and get a proper job. But apparently if a man sticks in over 40, he's pretty guaranteed work. Have you heard that?
I haven't heard that. I didn't know men had a period when they weren't working.
Oh, it's, really?
Look, some people have played the daughter... Mm. and the wife of the same actor. I mean, there are stories like that, you know, stories like that. And Sheila Hancock tells the story of her and John Thor. Mm-hmm. He wanted her to play his wife, which she was, in A Year in Provence, and they said, she's too old.
Wow.
I mean, how can we have let all that pass?
Yeah, that's incredible, because she really was his wife.
Yes, she really was his wife, yes. Yeah. Yeah, she told me that story, so it's not apocryphal. So
that's another question I want to ask. Who was at RADA with you? Was Sheila there?
No, she was ahead of me. Someone asked me that the other day, and I found it quite hard to think of anybody who's still working now.
Mm. Anyone a year above or below? You know, who was there at the same time? That's a, you know, there must have been a star.
Hang on. That's a question I should have thought about. And well, not even that, but sort of thought. Anthony Hopkins was there, just leaving.
Okay.
He was just leaving, and he had blue eyes.
Mm. Was he very good looking then?
Yes, he was.
Yeah.
And very Welsh, and had Richard Burton in his sights, I think, you know, that kind of. But he was very attractive. But I can just remember those blue eyes. And Timothy Dalton was below me.
Oh, my God.
So you never...
So he was gorgeous.
Oh, Richard Wilson was in the same year as me, not in the same class.
So is that the grave, what's it called? The one step in the grave?
Yes.
Yeah, the Scottish actor.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, he was there.
Fabulous.
So, yes, so there's... But of the women, I can't really think of any women who are still working who were there.
Gosh, that's terrible.
Yeah.
And then also I've really noticed that also the most annoying thing about the film biz is if someone's in a film, then the producer says, look, I've got this person. And because they've been in a film, they get the next role, and then they get the next role because they've been in the film. Mm-hmm. Like Helena Bonham Carter is just in every film. Mm-hmm. Personally, as an actress, I find her very irritating. And I don't find her particularly good. I think she was good when she was younger, but now she's just in everything. And it's like, can we just get somebody new? I don't mind if they're unheard of at all.
But that's how things get cast now.
I mean,
you know that.
Yes, but I think it's terrible.
They say, okay, we've got the scripts, we've got a director, we've even got some money. Now, where's the name? Mm. And that's how they cast. Mm. And a lot of casting directors complain about this, because when I was first in the business, I mean, how would I have got into telly without being seen by a casting director and being given a lead in something that was nominated for an Emmy? That's how I started my Granada times, when I was very lucky. But it was just chance. But I didn't have any sort of name at all. It was just, they said, oh, she's... They came and used to come and see people on stage and say, oh, we'll have them.
Do they still do that?
Not as much, probably, as they used to. Mm. Well, I expect they do. I mean,
I suppose there isn't rep now, though, is there?
Not in the same way that there was,
No, now there's just sort of small theatres, and then there's touring, and then there's West End, I suppose.
Yes, and also young people are going straight into telly now, which wasn't happening when I was a student, but we didn't even... Do you know, when I was at RADA, we didn't even have camera technique as a lesson. Yes, I had to learn that on the hoof while I was making Dracula Has Risen from the Grave.
Good time to learn it, because you were probably dead or something at the time.
No, I turned into a
A vampire.
A vampire, yes.
Wonderful.
Actually, I lie, that was my second film, but they were both horror films.
Okay, great.
And in the first film, the really nice director, Freddie Francis, said, "Now, Barbara, this is your first close-up." And I'd never had a close-up before in my life. I hadn't even done any telly. Well, I mean, I understood, but I said, what is my subtext? And he said, "Barbara, I've stuck a piece of paper on the side of a camera. Just see it there? Yes. Okay, look at it and look frightened." So I said,
fabulous.
"Okay, Freddie, thank you."
Fabulous. I mean, not frightened enough, a little bit more frightened, a little bit less frightened. I love it. I love it.
Oh, there are stories in horror films.
I mean, the thing is, though, about acting, especially on a screen, is that I suppose if you overact, it really shows. You've got to be subtle on the film.
That's right. And I learnt that from an actor called Michael Bryant. My God, he was in that first film with the piece of paper on the camera. And he was at the National Theatre, and he was famous. He's dead now. But he was wonderful, and he was talking. We were all talking, and someone said, "Quiet, action." And he didn't change his tone of voice. Like, he's just like I'm talking to you now. He was telling us something, and he turned to the camera, and he didn't
become an actor.
He just went on talking in that tone of voice and going on with the lines. So he was so real.
Okay.
It was absolutely wonderful.
So that's what you've got to do as an actress.
If you take deep breaths and go and open your eyes and all that, I think...
You look like a silent film star. Yeah.
Well, there's an art to it, that's all. A craft, let me say that.
Yes, craft.
A craft to it.
I always notice that thing about the swallow when they cry, when they're meant to feel moved. You know that? They always do that.
I know how to laugh, though. They did teach us around.
Oh, could you teach us? Yeah, come on, it's fun.
You really want to?
Yes.
Okay, all right then. Well, I'm not laughing now, right? And it's very, very hot today. Mm. And I'm thinking, gosh, it's hot, and I'm doing this interview and I'm boiling.
That's made you laugh. Is that the trick then?
Yeah. The trick is just nothing. You just do it. But it's because it's a kind of... Once you laugh, it's a bit like smiling. If you laugh, it makes yourself laugh.
Yeah.
So if I started by just doing that in the middle of a sentence, like a... and then I make myself laugh.
Yes.
And then I laugh. So it's a craft again.
Okay, what about crying?
Oh, that's different. Mm. I think that is a whole different thing, and that is a much more internal thing. I mean, the laughter thing is external.
I'll just tell you what I was taught at drama school, and that was the Stanislavski method, and that was to think of something sad. But the trouble with me is I thought of something sad and I couldn't stop crying.
You couldn't stop crying? Mm. Oh, that would have been useful. They would have been glad to have the real tears.
Then the other thing they said was keep your eyes open. Don't blink, and it makes your eyes well up. Have you heard that one?
No, I haven't heard that one. Well, so I expect different times. Mm. They taught different things.
Mm. So what were you taught about crying?
Well, simply that you had to put yourself into that moment. Mm. And, of course, you would use times of your own, but that was your business. It was putting yourself totally into the moment. Mm. And it's a much different... I think it's a very different thing from making yourself laugh.
Yeah, a lot harder.
Yes.
Yeah, a lot more difficult.
Well, some people can't laugh. It's such good fun laughing.
Yeah, yeah. So were you in comedies?
Some, but mostly... Oh, well, I was in a thing called Brass, which was a send-up.
I remember that.
It was a send-up of all the Northern Mining series, one of which I'd been in called Sam. So... I was, and when I went to...
So it was actually called Brass, though.
It was called Brass. Brass. But when I went for my interview, the authors were heard to say, "Oh, God, she's the one we're sending up." And the casting director knew my work and said, just see her. And so I did it. And then guess how I won them over? I had a very big bosom in Dracula Has Risen from the Grave, a big false bosom, which I made no secret that it was false. Everybody knew. I used to say in interviews, "This is a false bosom." So in Brass, I said, "Why don't we have her with a great big bosom? She never smiles. My Agnes Fairchild, she never smiled. She was always saying, 'Oh, son of mine, where are you going?'" And so they put in lines like, "Oh, son of mine, come back to the bosom of the family." And so That was a very, that took off.
Excellent.
And they
the
wrote about
it. The bosoms and the accent took
yes,
off.
Yes, but the authors went with it.
Yes.
And so
yes.
there was so much fabulous. Double entendre stuff.
Yeah,
it was
yeah.
a very, very clever
great
thing.
Fun.
We loved doing it. We used to meet for years and years afterwards because everyone loved their part.
Oh.
You know how some people hate their part and think,
yes,
I wish I had
yeah,
that part.
Yeah, yeah,
none
but they're embarrassed about it forever.
Yes.
Yeah.
No, we all loved our parts.
Oh, wonderful. And obviously it was massive comrade-y on it, yeah.
Yes, there was. It was, we really, and we liked, and also it was the first show that was ever done without a live audience, ever, a comedy show. And we didn't know, they said, no, we're going to really...
You don't know what's funny then.
No, yeah. except on the very first day of the television, first episode being done, Tim West and I were doing a scene, I won't tell you. It's too rude.
Oh no,
and
no,
the
we're
cameraman
into
and
I
the...
promise you, we're into rudeness. Is very rudeness is Radio Gorgeous.
Well, we were. My job, I had to take piecework because we were so poor, and I had to pack contraceptives. What I forget for the army or some prophylactics or something. Okay. But you blew them up and you put a hole in some of them for the church. You know. Anyway, the cameras shook. Because the cameramen were laughing so much, they had to cut. So we thought, oh, well, we're onto something here. And
excellent.
I think it actually gave us quite a lot of confidence.
Exactly.
And it was very, it won awards and things, so it was very popular.
Fabulous, fabulous. Now, tell us about your writing. So obviously there was the acting, but you also had the writing bug. Where did that come from?
Well, I'd always kept a diary since I was 11. Mm. Which later became a journal. So I'd always written things down. But really, I had had a novel published once, a long time before that. But when Glenda went into Parliament, I thought, well, what am I going to do? Because she's much more famous than me. What will I do? And then I thought, why don't I tell what happens? And so that started me off on my real career. And then I went on from there and I got into... I wrote a book, my second book, for which they'd given me a two-book deal. They thought they'd get actresses too or something, and they got a novel about race relations in 1950s New Zealand.
Wow.
Oh, wow. You say that. They didn't say wow. They said, what the...
Yeah.
And they said, we can't... What do you think you're doing? Anyway, finally... Virago, who saved me over and over again. This time Virago said, we'll publish it.
Correct.
And it was nominated for the Orange Prize.
Fabulous.
So I was going in different directions, but I was pulled back to the commercial sort of thing.
Yeah.
And then I started writing historical novels.
Okay, so historical novels, are they romances? Or
they're everything, often with a thriller plot, because I do think you need people to
I've done them about
a woman in the 18th century trying to be an artist, where if your father or your husband wasn't an artist, no chance. But she found a way of, you know, so that's the one I think I am very, very fond of. I wrote
what
one
book's that called what's that
it's
called?
Called The Fraud. And then there's one called The Rosetta Stone. Oh, no, it's called Rosetta, which was about Egypt. And I realised I had to go to Egypt, but I wouldn't be able to get the feeling of the place. So research became so important to me. And I did one about ships crossing between the southern and northern hemispheres in the olden days, all that. And the last historical novel I did was called The Petticoat Men. And it was about a gay trial. In 1849,
and
I think.
And it really happened?
It really happened, but gays had written about it, and I wasn't going to... Of course, I am not gay, and I wasn't going to write about it. I was writing about something else, actually. And I came across some new information about their trial, just by chance, because I had a letter of Gladstone's, William Gladstone's, and I went, I don't believe this. And I stood up in the British Library and went, what? And you know, I blushed and had to go out and all that. And finally, I got permission from the Gladstone family to publish that letter. The Queen would not give, or the Royal Archives would not give me letters from the other person involved, which was Edward VII.
Wow.
When he was Prince of Wales.
Wow.
And this was about a gay trial. I'll say no more, but it's called The Petticoat Men. And so I did actually find new information.
It was a scoop. You turned into a journalist.
It was a sort of a scoop. It was very exciting. But often it's just about women trying that. I've done one called The Mesmerist, which I had went and looked at mesmerism, which was the forerunner of hypnotism. In hospitals, they even had mesmeric hospitals because... It was a way, it did put people out in a way.
Yes, it was a way of not using kind of ether or whatever.
Ether. Ether and chloroform were found, mesmerism disappeared.
So mesmerism, the idea was that, but I'm sure, did it work though? I'm intrigued.
Yes, it did work, and I believed it didn't. And so I was going to have this again, it was two 19th century actresses. I thought, I'll have such fun with this. And they were so poor that they decided to set up a spiritual business. And so
you didn't believe it when you started off, but by the end of it, you did.
I did because of the research I did. And I went to pain clinics and I talked to some people in them and they said, oh, yes, definitely it worked in some cases. You had to be willing to go with it always. Mm-hmm. A bit like hypnotism. I don't think you can be hypnotized totally against your will.
But I'll never forget, I was having a bridge done when I was about 22 with a New Zealand dentist, actually.
Oh, they're the best.
And he said, oh, and I'm just about to give you a painkiller, and then about 10 minutes later, I went, oh, it's really good, he said, I haven't done it yet. But I really went into this kind of trance. And
he was hypnotising
you.
Yes, dentists use it a lot.
Yeah,
it's very interesting. Well, mesmerism was a kind of forerunner of that, and it was so interesting. What a lot I learned.
Now, let's talk about New Zealand, because you're very proud to be from there, but you don't live there.
I go there lots.
Yeah, and tell us about your childhood.
We were part of the empire, Josephine. We were part of the empire.
And you felt that strongly.
And the king was our king.
Mm-hmm. Which king was that?
King George. I know how young you are. George the VI.
Yeah.
And, you know, we saved pictures of the royal family. And, I mean, we were absolutely part of the empire. Mm-hmm. And poor little England after the war, we were told. You know, they didn't have food, but we saved them by sending them butter and our milk and all our products and all that. Well, of course, when they joined the EU, New Zealand just went, woomph.
Oh, no.
Oh,
really?
Yes. But it was very good for them because they had to do all
become
sorts
self-reliant.
Of...
Become self-reliant, yeah.
Well, no. Well, they did become...
They diversified,
but also they started selling their products to the East and to Iran and to China.
Yeah,
so we've
much
been
bigger
doing,
market.
Yeah,
and nearer home.
I know all those air miles, everything. But I'm very interested that the British are going around now saying, "Oh, we'll get the empire back, and we'll be doing it." And I think, "Oh well, we'll see."
Total rubbish. We won't.
No, we won't.
We'll actually stick with Europe. I hope. I mean, in the end. Yeah, you were brought up like this, so you were brought up to think that Britain was great.
Britain, my parents, who'd been born in New Zealand, called England home.
Wow.
And I didn't, a lot of people did, were sort of quite intellectually snobby and wanted to go where the real intellectualism was, which was England. And so it was hard for New Zealand literature to develop, but a lot of writers stayed there, and not just writers, painters, and slowly, I mean, it's a fabulous scene there now, and I do go back, and I do go back and work. When I was an actress, I was going home and playing parts there, and coming and going, and I was married to a New Zealander for many years, so we were coming and going.
So you chose another New Zealander in the end.
Well, you know, it didn't matter. We came and we went. He was a New Zealand Maori, and so he had a whole.
So this is
of,
where you got the book from.
Well, I had already written the book, but that whole thing of the race relations were very patronising, and it's very, very interesting to look at it later and to see. But we did believe in an equal society. There really wasn't the class system. When I came to, because I was sent on a scholarship to come to RADA, I could not believe how people treated other people. I literally couldn't believe it. because that's not how it was. And I think a lot of our forebears came to New Zealand wanting to have a more equal life. And, you know, we had a health service. We were the first to give votes to women. You know, it was a different place. Yes. But
more modern.
In a way, but still tied to the empire. Yeah. But very puritanical and honest and, you know, wouldn't allow anything.
So tell us about the class system, because I know it's very subtle now, the class system in England. It's like, which school did you go to? Which university? You kind of judge people on their accents. You know, we do without even realising it. I don't treat anybody differently just because of who they are. You know what I mean? That doesn't. But I am aware of what
people are. Well, you're talking about yourself. I mean, it's.
Yeah, I'm talking about myself. But I'm wondering, you said when you came to Britain, tell us what it was like then, is it in the early 60s?
Well,
how did it show itself?
I've already told you that at RADA they wanted me to change my accent because they said I couldn't work if I didn't change it.
Well, I must say they said that to me at drama school in the late 80s.
What was your accent?
Not to me, but to other people. They said you've got to be able to speak RP, otherwise you won't get
work. Well,
they
were right in a way, but they were just taking my heart away from me. And I've said that to them and held on to my heart and all that. But, of course, they were right. And so I developed a form of RP, which...
OK, so you do... I can hear your accent a little bit.
Well, you can especially hear it if I laugh or if I'm drunk.
OK, OK.
Yes.
And was it stronger and has it lessened because you've been here for so long?
Oh, yes, of course. Yes, my friends at home call me a pom.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. You know. Yeah. So it has, and when I'm with New Zealanders, it comes out
totally.
More.
Yeah.
So it's a very interesting thing, but it's certainly you can't be yourself if you're thinking, "Am I sounding right?" When you're acting, I mean, you can't be true, is what I'm trying to say.
But then you were doing an RP accent, then on top of it, you were doing an English accent, like a Northern accent.
Yes. Well, that's right. A man complex. Came up to me once and said, "Elas, I know exactly where you're from. It's outside Bolton, isn't it?"
Oh.
And I said, "Oh, thank you."
just don't put him wrong. Sweet man. Yeah, lovely. Lovely. So, let's see what other question I've got for you. So which art have you found most fulfilling, writing or the stage?
I think they're connected. Mm-hmm. I think they use the same part of your brain. If you're doing good acting in good plays, and, you know, I don't mean some of the stuff we had to do, but, you know, if you're doing stuff and if you're writing well, I think the same creative part goes. But in a way, acting is more of a craft. We were talking earlier about craft, and whereas writing is more of a creation, I think. But good acting can be just as creative.
And the only thing about acting is you're doing somebody else's lines, whereas you are writing the lines.
Yes. Yeah. Well, you said you wrote you're writing something for yourself, and I've written a one-woman play that I took all around the world. So, and that was because there was no parts.
And what play was that?
It was about a woman called Alexandra Kollontai, and she was the only woman in Lenin's cabinet. And she was the first woman diplomat in the world, because when she caused trouble, he sent her to Norway rather than kill her. And she had a toy boy. Her lover was somebody... and she was a solo mother. So she had a lot of modernity.
So she's a commie, solo... Yeah.
Well, she had been married, but she was left looking after... Yeah. But she was very, very well educated and spoke various languages. So she was very, very useful to Lenin. But Stalin wanted her out of the... You know, sort of out
so
of...
So what was the drama in your one-woman show?
Because her lover got killed and she
by the Russians?
Oh, yes, yes. And they were all being knocked off, and it was all got more and more dangerous. And she was sent to a Norway and lived next door to Grieg. I can't believe this, but that apparently is what it was. And was a bit too useful and a bit too... They had to be careful who they knocked off, I think. But it was very...
She was too much in the public eye, I suppose.
It's very hard to know, because women were not... It was a very patriarchal society.
And is she still alive?
No, but her grandson is still alive. Mm. And I became his grandson. Oh no, he's dead now, but he was still alive when I was doing the.
Lovely.
And he and his wife came to see and talk to me about her. And then they came to stay with me in London. And I thought, talk about touching history. I've given them my bed to Alexandra's grandson, you know, it's just amazing. So again, that required an immense amount of research.
So it sounds like it's the research you like.
I like the writing too, but I love the research. I failed history at university, perhaps that's
okay.
Why.
So, but you've never got over it, so you'll never stop.
We were learning British kings and queens, and we lived in New Zealand.
Dull.
And it was deeply dull.
Yeah.
Whereas now I'm quite interested in who was. I see. Queen Victoria's son was involved in a gay trial, was he? Let me see if I can follow this through. You know.
So you're more interested in the kind of sub history.
I suppose I am. Well, of course, the thing about mesmerism is it's not really sub-history, it's just part of the history of medicine.
Well, I'm interested in, I'd say if I'm interested in, social history, so what people wore, what people ate, what people,
yes.
So
that
culture.
Makes it more interesting.
Yeah, because that's, it's sort of, that reflects everything that we are, you know, and what manners and what, you know, I'm really interested in dress, manners.
Imagine I've worn the dresses on stage, and so that I could then say, you can't go to the toilet. There are no public toilets, you know, because women weren't supposed to go out. And so all the stuff I'd learnt and wearing a corset and what it was like and how horrible, I've done it on stage hundreds of times. So I've been able to join all those bits together. And as you say, what they ate and everything.
And how they spoke to each other and how they treated each other.
Yes, and the class system.
Yeah, and the class system was just very, very, very important until, I'd say, the Second World War. That's really when everything changed, broke down.
Did it?
And the 60s.
I think the 60s was a bit, it was still there.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, Mick Jagger tried to hide. He went to a public school.
And he went to grammar, but do you think it's broken down more now, though? I am coming back to the same subject.
Yes, you are. And I think it's something different now. It's about money.
And super rich,
and what you can buy with it, because you could certainly buy honours. There's no question. I'm not going to make any libelous statements, but there is no question that you can buy honours and things. So
still, though, I do have a friend who's American, and she says, no matter how rich people can be in Britain, she says there will always, you know, there'll be always a slight divide between whether you're nouveau or.
But that's because there's a royal family.
Oh, yes.
Because it's the head of it.
Okay. Yeah, the head of the poshness. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see. So the royal family actually is what gives it. Yeah, and private schools.
That all comes from, you know...
Where they're going to go to school.
From,
exactly. They've got to have schools for kings.
Well, they used to have governesses and private, that sort of thing.
Yeah. No, that's a really... no one's ever explained it like
really?
I've never thought... That the royals set the kind of poshness of the
country. Of course, they are the top of the.
But what's hysterical is I had a boyfriend once, and his granny thought she was so posh. She looked down on the Queen.
that was really
funny. So, why should we all go out and buy the actresses? Let's go back to your book.
I just think it's for women, and especially for, I say older women. I'm talking, I mean, you're not allowed to say, you're not allowed to say menopausal women, because that is, you know, and I don't see why we have to be ashamed of all those
things. Well, I'm on the HRT, so.
Well, of course, and it's good, isn't it?
Yes, great.
So was I for years. I would never have gone off if I could have stayed on.
Same.
Mrs. Thatcher was on HRT.
Brilliant.
Everybody.
Well, she ruled the country on it, darling.
Yes. Indeed, darling.
Why should we buy it?
Yes, I'm just trying to think of reasons. I think women of that. I mean, I think everybody should buy it because it's a thriller. I mean, it's a thriller. Mm. If you want to read and you want to have don't you want to know what actually happens?
Exactly.
Yes, and I think that it is definitely a page turner because it's a thriller. So if you don't want to know about any women's stuff, that's fine because there's plenty of other stuff going on as well. I think for women of that age, of your age, it's so important not to feel put down and finished and all that shit.
You can swear on Radio Gorgeous.
Oh, can you?
We encourage it.
Oh, do you? I've stopped myself several times. all that stuff that comes out. Well, just the other day, there was something talking about the Bank of England was menopausal, weren't they, or something. There was anyway. Mm. We can't talk, but women who are being pushed in that way. Mm-hmm. Should say that's not how it is, and that's how it's been told, but not by us. And I'm telling it not like that. That's all I'm going to say about the plot. And I don't want to give away a lot, but as you will find out, the women do all right.
That's all we want to know in the end.
Yes.
The women do all right.
And they are the women of a certain age who do all right.
Exactly. And let us into a secret, Barbara. What are you writing now?
I'm not going to tell you.
Oh, okay.
I am writing something, but I very seldom talk about what I'm writing while I'm doing it, and I'm not talking about this.
Okay. So The Actresses by Head of Zeus is out now. Please go and buy it. And you'll always find dramatic women on RadioGorgeous.com.